Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh, National Geographic. Here's a special on new discoveries of the Maya Biosphere Reserve. Yet Augustana University students have been following Professor David O'Hara into the region for years. He recently returned from teaching there in January. He joins me now in the studio. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with painting the big picture here and tell me about this trip, because I love following you on social media when you go down and visit, but sometimes it's hard to tell for me where you're at exactly. So where do you go and why?
Sure. The class that I teach with Augustana Professor Craig Spencer is a class in tropical ecology. So that's the course name in the catalog. Where we go is the northern part of Guatemala, the Petén department, and that's where the Maya Biosphere Reserve is. And we spend a couple of weeks there working with a Maya nonprofit that's trying to help to preserve some of their language and culture in the forest. And then we spend about a week over on off the coast of Belize on the second largest barrier reef in the world. So it's a tropical ecology of the forest and of the ocean.
And how long have you been going?
It's about 10 years that wow. I've been going down there, yeah. I go down 2 out of every 3 Januaries.
How did it start? I mean, how did that conversation start?
Well, it started, actually, it was my colleague Craig Spencer who started it, and it started somewhat by accident. He was on sabbatical, and a friend of his was doing some research, some paleolimnology research. That is to say, he was drilling down in, some core samples from the bottom of a deep lake in the middle of the Petén region. And Craig is also a paleolimnologist. He went along, and one thing led to another, and he decided, I'm going to teach a class down here. Then he invited me to come along because I speak Spanish and I'm interested in ecology.
All right. And 10 years, so much has changed down there or not?
It's changing very rapidly.
Right. Yeah. And that might not be a good thing, I'm guessing.
Well, or? Right. You're right. It's the good thing is that there are people who need land, and they are finding land there when they're burning forests down. And for a couple of years, they are able to grow corn and feed their families. Anyone who's working hard to feed their families, they're doing a good thing. The bad thing is that land's not going to last very long, and they've burned down something like half of the Petén in the last 20 years. Hmm. So they're in real danger right now.
Is there a heated dialogue about the controversy of that, or is it not really controversial? It's all systems forward.
Well, up until about the 1980s or early 1990s, Guatemala was embroiled in its own civil war. It lasted for 30 years or so, and they ignored the Petén. It makes up about a third of Guatemala, but they ignored it because most of the population was in the south of Guatemala. That's where the economy is, that's where the politics, and that's where the fighting was. That meant that this section of Guatemala was sort of like our Wild West was 125, 150 years ago. It was kind of off the radar. It's a problem for Guatemala now, and they're just starting to wake up to it. And I think Americans should start to wake up to it too, because it's being deforested because of population pressures. But when that forest is gone, that population needs somewhere else to go. So if you're wondering why are so many people moving north and trying to cross the border into the United States, a big part of it is that Central America is running out of land to feed their people.
Hmm. All right, so you take students down, tropical ecology, what do you do? What's the day like?
Well, we spend most of the time living, for the first week or so, living in homes. We rent rooms in homes in a small village. Most of the people are descendants of the Maya Itza people. Up until about 40 years ago, Itza was the language that they spoke. There were no roads there, no currency there. They've now entered into the modern age. I know most of them on Facebook now, but you know, everyone's got a smartphone. But anyway, we live with these families. Our students study Spanish, and we go off to the reserve that they are trying to protect, and we try to learn about their culture, their history, their language. We observe the animals and the plants in the forest, and we try to get to know on the ground in a hands-on way not only what's the ecology of the place like, but how are the people and the ecology associated with one another.
All right. You have to teach them what? To slow down? To notice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. One of my sort of philosophical heroes, Kathleen Dean Moore, says sometimes the most loving thing that you can say to somebody is, look. So I like to think of this as kind of an act of love, of bringing students into this place and say, look. We go on about a 3-day, 40-mile trek through the forest as well and wind up in Tikal, which is probably the part of the Petén that most people know, if they know anything about that part of Guatemala. That's an ancient Maya city, and the ruins are one of the few tourist destinations in that part of Guatemala. So during that trek, we've got no cell signal, no internet. We just walk slowly through the forest, listen to the birds, see the butterflies, try not to touch anything that might sting you, and get woken by howler monkeys early in the morning.
Don't touch anything that kills you.
Yeah, that's a good rule for life, isn't it?
How long does it take them to really slow down and, you know, step into that space? Can you look around and say, yep, they're there now? Like, we've got them. They've shifted to a different frame of mind and a different way of seeing.
Well, yeah, you mentioned following me on social media. The things that I keep posting when I do wind up getting cell signals are photos of my students just enraptured with the place. It doesn't take very long at all.
Yeah.
I love it when, it's just one example, we get off the boat, we're on the reef in Belize. I have a rule. I'm the first one off the boat and the last one back on, because I don't want my students to take risks that I'm not willing to take. I want to be the first in the water, make sure everything's okay, last in the water, make sure everyone gets on board. But other than that, I don't have to give them any rules. I hop off the boat, you know, I make sure that my snorkel gear is working fine and watch the students get in, and they are off. The wonder and the beauty of the place is like that. It's a little bit different in Guatemala in that it's a little slower. You know, they're not in such a foreign environment like we are on the reef, but they meet the children in San Jose. They go walking through the forest and they see the mushrooms that they've never seen before. They hear the monkeys, they see the birds, and they are just caught up in the moment. It's a great classroom.
Yeah. What do you think they'll take with them into, because what kind of majors are these? What are they studying?
Most of the students who come along are bio majors.
Okay.
We require that they all have some Spanish and some bio in their background, but we'll bring along students who are nursing majors and even philosophy majors as well. I teach environmental philosophy and environmental humanities at Augustana. So some of the students are interested in going on to study environmental law, for instance. Hmm. But by and large, these are students who are going to go on to become physicians. And one of the things I hope for is that when these students are treating people from Central America, if they're working here in a hospital years from now, they'll have a sense of culturally where these people are coming from, what sorts of needs they have. They've maybe spent some time in a clinic down in Guatemala or volunteering in a school or in the animal hospital. They've got a sense of the language that people speak, what they need, what their diet is like. But I think more than anything, what I want, Lori, is I want my students to come back to the United States unable to think of Central America and its people as abstractions. Mm. I want them to know people and never to just think of Central Americans as something. They've lived in a home. They've played games with children. They've swum in the lake with the children and cooked with the families. And these are real people with real interests very much like our own.
Tell me about the reserve itself, the Maya Biosphere Reserve. As I'm watching the National Geographic special, everything's new. You can remove the trees through a laser and remove the view of the trees, not actually removing the trees, but see this civilization that was there before. You've seen this up close without a laser.
Yeah, that's right. So like I said, the Petén Department's about a third of Guatemala, and up until the late 80s or early 90s, it was largely uninhabited, in the same way that South Dakota was largely uninhabited. That is to say, there was a very small population. It was an indigenous population. So there's a very small number of indigenous people living in that area. That meant they had almost no roads, just a few trails. The only commerce they had was chicle. That's the gum that comes from the chicle, or the chico zapote tree, or the chicle tree, that was used by American chewing gum companies. So there's a few airstrips scattered here and there in the forest where big planes would land and take the chicle gum back up to the United States. But what happened was, when the Civil War ended, there was this huge migration push, and the population of the Maya Biosphere Reserve started to grow by about 10% a year.
Hmm.
And the Guatemalan government realized, we are going to wind up destroying this entire forest and everything that comes with it, all the mahogany trees that are growing there, all the biodiversity that could draw tourists and that could provide us with medicines and so on. And, of course, lots of archaeology. The largest pyramid in the world, larger than anything in Egypt and anything in Mexico, is in the northern border of Guatemala.
Hmm.
And Mel Gibson has been funding the excavation and the preservation of El Mirador, this largest pyramid. When my students and I walk through this forest, oftentimes I'll stop and point out and say, you're walking on stone, and the stone that you're walking on is cut stone. and it's hard to notice it because this is limestone. It kind of breaks down pretty quickly. But they'll look and realize, oh, my goodness, what are we walking on? And the answer is we're walking through an ancient city. It looks like we're deep in a forest, but this is a city that spans dozens of miles wide. Mm. And it's just building after building after building. But it doesn't look like that unless you know what to look for. What National Geographic aired last night was a video about using LIDAR, or using lasers that can pierce down through the forest canopy a couple hundred feet down and see all those structures. And we're realizing, oh my goodness, there was an enormous population here 1,000 years ago. It wasn't just the wild, savage jungle. This was a very sophisticated, very large city.
Who brought you there? You know, who has helped you see, you know, what was there underneath your own feet?
Chicleros. Those are the people who harvested the chicle. And all of these are indigenous people. So they're the Itza people that I mentioned before, and then some Kekchi people who have moved in from other parts of Guatemala. And we hire them as guides. They make their living ushering tourists through. Not a whole lot go through there. It's still pretty remote, but they're our guides.
Environmental humanities. What does that encompass?
Yeah, we often think about environmental studies in terms of environmental science. So you're going out and taking measurements of the world. Environmental humanities is interested in all the other parts of the environment. So what are the stories that we tell about the environment? What are the words that we use to describe it? So just by way of example, words like skunk, chipmunk, moose, those are words that came from Native American languages. Mm. But they were associated with animals that live only here. So when Europeans came here, they adopted the language of Native Americans. Environmental humanities is also interested in nature writing. You know, you think about, you know, John Muir or Henry David Thoreau or any of the other great environmental writers. And of course, it's got a very practical implication. How do we form environmental policies and environmental laws? What should be the environmental ethic that we pursue? And it's not always easy. I took an environmental law class at Vermont Law School a couple of years ago. And in my class, I had people who were U.S. Navy lawyers who are trying to figure out how do we make the best use of sonar without damaging aquatic mammals like porpoises and dolphins. We had people who were working for oil companies trying to figure out how do we obey the laws and make sure that we still maximize profit. And we had people in there who were planning to work for nonprofits that were like environmental defense and conservation organizations. These are big questions, and they're more than scientific questions.
And the philosopher from South Dakota.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so a philosopher from South Dakota teaches classical Greek and language and Greek philosophy is really interested in fish and forests.
And so in that group, those don't always get along. What kind of conversations, you know, is it possible to learn from each other in that scenario too, where you might have someone who is inclined to environmental activism, you know, sitting and learning next to someone who is inclined to maximize profits, and obey the environmental laws, but maybe they'd like some fewer laws and regulations and restrictions.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking a really pertinent question, especially at a time when I think lots of us feel a lot of political divisiveness in our in our public conversation. I think the answer is you talk to people, just like you're doing right now. So, for instance, my environmental policy class at Augustana, I Skype in with forest rangers in Guatemala, and I Skype in with people who are trying to harvest the wood in Guatemala. And I Skype in with environmental activists in Alaska and with oil company attorneys in Alaska. And what I find, and my students find, is that all these people are, like I was saying before, real people with real interests who want to feed their families and who want to love their neighbors as themselves. When you actually engage people in conversation, you realize we share a tremendous amount in common. You know, if you're an oil company executive working in Alaska, it's not that you're some sort of evil beast who just wants to destroy the environment.
Right.
Most likely you're somebody who has got skills and you're wanting to use them to better your family and your neighbors. And the same goes for the person who's working for the Sierra Club or working for some other kind of a Trout Unlimited or any of the other environmental organizations. We share a tremendous amount in common. We shouldn't let those few things that we disagree upon divide us completely. We've got a lot of grounds for conversation with one another.
What is coming home like?
Coming home is always a little bit tiring and a little bit refreshing. I'm glad that the mosquitoes aren't flying around right now.
Right.
You know, I'm still scratching insect bites from being in the forest for so long. Like I said, I come back with a sense of renewed commitment to the people that I've come to know, the people that I know face to face and by name. Part of my work when I was in Guatemala this past month was interviewing one of the last seven people who speaks Itza. So when he dies and when his family dies, I'm getting choked up thinking about this, when they're gone, their language will be effectively gone. It's a little bit like watching the extinction of Native American languages here in the United States. And so I spent a lot of time, my son, who's an environmental photographer, he came along with me, and the two of us made a lot of videos and recordings of him speaking in his language and teaching us about his environmental values. That's something that I will treasure in my heart for a long time, and that I hope to publish sometime soon, too.
David O'Hare, our time always goes too quickly. So you will come back, I'm hoping, and share more of this story. And we'll put some links up on our website, listen.sdpb.org, to help people find you on social media so they can see some of those remarkable photos and such. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure, Lori.